Let's start with what Lloyd Austin said. He says that Putin will not stop at Ukraine, but as President Biden has said, Ukraine can stop Putin if we stand with Ukraine and provide the weapons it needs to defend itself. Ukraine's survival is on the line, and all of our security is on the line. Your take on what Lloyd Austin said?
Two aspects of it that are potentially true. One, he's a lackey and he's not giving the president good advice. He's merely parroting what the president says. I can't believe that he's had, or that the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff has had, a very good conversation with Biden over this business of Ukraine. I just can't, because otherwise I'd have to have a huge factor of disbelief. Or the second possibility is he's just lying. Either one with this man, I think, is a possibility. I've followed his career since he was a combatant commander, and he's very much a yes man. And in this case, it's very dangerous because we are at a point now where if we don't get to some sort of negotiated ceasefire and talks, then, as I've said so many times before, war has its own dynamic. And we're going to wind up with Ukraine losing more that Putin might not even really want because he can. And this is not a way to do business. And the idea that he is in the future contemplating attacking a NATO country, an actual NATO country, is preposterous. What would he want to do that for? I mean, you're risking World War III just as we would be risking World War III, significantly risking it, if we entered the fray in Ukraine. So it's absurd. And I don't know what kind of insanity pill Austin, Biden, Sullivan, Blinken, and others in Washington are taking, but I know they are certifiable and they ought to be put in an asylum.
Do you find it the policy of the moment? I'm talking about this particular moment that they're in for the 2024 election.
I think there has to be, but we're at a point now where, as I just indicated, a week ago I would have said, okay, prestige is on the line, what Dean Acheson called the shadow of power. The election is on the line. As long as more than 50% of the American people support the efforts in Ukraine, prestige and the elections are on the line. But I don't think that's true anymore. I think we're looking at a situation now that is intrinsic to US national security and certainly intrinsic to European security. And for that matter, also Ukraine's and Russia's. And it's become almost a borderline existential issue. It already is for Putin. He said that many times, and it is. Joe Biden said that years ago when he was vice president. Bill Burns said that years ago when he had a brain. I think Anthony Blinken actually said that when he was working for Joe Biden a few years ago. President Obama said that. It's existential for Putin. Well, we're making it existential for ourselves. For an election, I cannot believe that Joe Biden is that unwise, that stupid.
Do you see the Republican Party getting to the point that they may get along with the Biden policy in Ukraine, or they're getting more against the policy in Ukraine?
The Republicans' main dictum is to always oppose whatever the president is doing, unless we happen to go along with it, and then we'll figure out a way to oppose him, but still get what we want or try to. I think on Ukraine, you've got a group within the Republican Party that is rather inchoate right now. It doesn't know how to get along to a policy change or to attempt one. It's trying to deal with it from a number of different perspectives, one of which is just pure politics, and that's the holdup on the Ukraine, the last tranche of Ukrainian money that the Congress needs to approve. And oh, by the way, we're breeding all kinds of Export-Import Act, foreign military sale, all manner of problems right now with both the Pentagon and the president finding money and giving it to Ukraine in the interim and also to Israel. We're violating the law. These are impeachable offenses. James Madison, the father of our Constitution, said The executive war power is the true nurse of executive aggrandizement. He was absolutely right. And that's what we're seeing now. What's happening are actually impeachable offenses in the eyes of our founding fathers. We made a farce of the impeachment process, but these are genuine impeachable offenses, giving money from the American taxpayer to a foreign power without the House of Representatives and the Congress as a whole approving that money. This is an impeachable offense. So we're treading in some very dangerous territory with regard to our own situation, and very much so with regard to NATO and Europe's situation, because we're killing people for no purpose, and we are opening Pandora's box with regard to how this could escalate. I don't think it will, because I think Putin is smart enough not to let it escalate. But I'm worried about us. I'm worried about the United States, because, as I said, we are showing so little ability to think wisely, to think sagaciously, to think about our real national security interests. We're just doing this based on a initial attempt by the neoconservatives within the administration to bleed Russia through Ukraine. It did not work. It has been a colossal failure. Ergo, we should now halt that failure. You know, the old dictum about when you're in a hole, digging yourself in deeper and deeper, the first thing you do is stop digging, toss the shovel away, and try to climb out. That's what we need to do now. But I don't see any inclination to do that, not until November. And as I said, I don't think that's a motivation anymore. That domestic political motivation has to go by the wayside. The president should use the bully pulpit to bring that 55% or so of Americans down on the Ukraine situation. He should tell them the truth. Quit lying to them.
Lindsey Graham is asking Ukrainians to change the law to send younger people to the battleground. Is there anybody out there take these people accountable for what they're saying and what they're advocating for?
Well, you just put your finger on it. That's Graham's problem. And incidentally, it was Biden's problem when he was in the Congress on more than one occasion. They don't have any responsibility. They have no responsibility whatsoever for those boys and girls that are going to die, for the war that's going to result from their words or whatever. So they can pontificate all day long. And Lindsey Graham pontificates to get his voters in South Carolina. I know him. I'm from South Carolina. My father knew Lindsey Graham and quit giving him any money because he said one day, Lindsey broke his promise. Lindsey said he would be term limited. He wasn't. I said, "You're right, Dad. He's a lying sack of proverbial horse manure." And my dad said, "You're right, son." My dad's dead now, but he wouldn't cast another vote for Lindsey Graham. And I didn't blame him a bit. Lindsey is a terrible politician, except that he can keep getting reelected.
The head of Russian intelligence said that France is going to send a group of 20,000 soldiers to Ukraine. And we heard the same thing in the French media. They're talking about sending troops to Ukraine. Do they really think that this amount of soldiers, this number of soldiers, would solve anything for Ukraine?
Nothing. If Britain and France combined their ground forces and sent them to Ukraine, they'd be ground up. So we're just talking nonsense here. And we're having the usual problems we have with allies, particularly in NATO. We're having one country try to outdo another country, Oh, the United States is backing away. I think I'll take over the alliance now. That sort of thing's going on. It's treacherous. It's one of the weaknesses, significant weaknesses of alliances. And we've been able to keep it down in NATO because we have not had a threat. Not really. Not since the disappearance of the Soviet Union. And the Soviet Union was a threat enough to keep everybody in some kind of equanimity. You know, the old adage was the NATO was created to keep Russia out, Germany down, and the U.S. in. Sorry, gone now. The fact that we've resurrected Russia as a threat is not going to do the bidding of NATO. And so, as I've said, you're going to find NATO frazzled, falling apart as soon as this situation. Maybe that's one reason they don't want to solve it. Maybe that is one reason they do not want a negotiated ceasefire and to go to negotiations in Brussels, because they realize as soon as this is gone, they're going to collapse. They're going to fall apart because 32 countries is too unwieldy, cannot be kept together. Can you imagine what's going to happen if all 32 of them get to bickering with one another? And that's what's going to happen absent a real threat.
Two countries joined NATO, Finland and Sweden. Sweden, it seems that they're about to send German, Swedish Taurus missiles to Ukraine. It's amazing to see how Sweden is getting involved in this conflict. And what's the necessity of doing that for Sweden?
I think you're seeing what some military experts are telling me they think is going on right now, at least at a lower level. You're seeing these countries who have never been involved or haven't been involved in the lifetime of their militaries, any real conflicts. You're seeing them use this as a testing ground. You're seeing them use this for their weapons tests. You're seeing them use it for all manner of tactics and such tests and exams. And that's understandable, but let's do it on the training ground. Let's not do it in an actual war where we're killing people. And that's what we're doing now. We're killing people for nothing. That's too often the case with the United States. We kill people for nothing in Afghanistan. We kill people for nothing in Iraq. We kill people for nothing in Libya. We kill people for nothing in Syria. It's time to stop. If you look at the battlefield and you look at the lines and you look at the battles that have been fought and the armaments that have been used, the high technology and such, I think the casualty count, both KIA and WIA, wounded and killed, is probably double what the official sources are saying. That's sort of like bomb damage assessment after the war is over. Half the bombs never hit their target. Well, it's the other way around with casualties. And many people don't realize this. The biggest killer in a war like this, in Afghanistan, in Iraq, in Syria, the biggest killer is non-hostile action. A tank runs over you. A grenade goes off in your foxhole that you pull the pin on and didn't throw properly. Non-hostile action, casualties are often as high, or as us in Afghanistan, higher than the actual combat casualties.
Europeans are talking about putting their economy on a military track.
In terms of the Russians, you know, all you have to do is look at just about any war, but particularly look at World War II and the Wehrmacht and Germany in general, and look at Russia in general and see what war will do for you in terms of building your heavy industry, in terms of building your industrial base, and in terms of, even with high technology, which is a little bit different industrial base now, but you see what it'll do for you. Now, it's not necessarily sustainable. We did the same thing. You know, the last year of World War II, 1945, we built 50,000 airplanes in that single year. When we quit the war, we had 7,000 ships in the Army. We have 13,000 in the Navy. We left things in Tokyo Bay and built a reef there that fishermen now still fish on because it was more expensive to bring them home than to leave them there and sink them in the ocean. So war economies do produce a lot, and they do fast, and they do a lot for your industrial base. But that doesn't last. It's not sustainable unless you keep the war up and you keep going. In that case, you just deprive your citizens of all the things that they ought to have, and instead you substitute for your industry the output for war. And the Germans ran into that. We ran into that. The Russians ran into that. My grandmother and others used to tell me about the savings bond runs and the gathering the aluminum foil and everything else for the war effort. You can only sustain that amongst your people for so long.
The Washington Post reported that there are Ukrainian villages with no men left. Do you think that this lack of people to fight this war in Ukraine is one of the reasons that in Europe you hear that they're preparing to send troops to Ukraine?
I think it's a demonstration of Clausewitz's theory of the dynamics of warfare and the nature of war and how it changes as circumstances change and as victors become losers and losers become victors. And it has something to do with the money that their defense contractors are making. And it has something to do with the leadership in NATO. And when a void appears, especially if it's Washington, Congress won't pass the money and such, then other people start, this is one of the weaknesses of alliances, start leaping in and trying to assume the mantle of leadership. And soon you have chaos. And meanwhile, you have people still dying. That's the situation here. That's what we need to stop is, as you pointed out, Ukraine won't have anybody left.
When you look at NATO today, at the history of NATO in the last 30 years, in the last 20 years, do you see any successful mission?
Has there been a successful mission led by the United States of America in the last 50 years? Other than, and here's the key, the fulfillment of the United Nations mandate and no further in the first Iraq war, where the United Nations said, remove Saddam's army from where it invaded. It crossed the border. It violated the UN's rules about territorial integrity. 600,000 people, the French, the Syrians, the Egyptians, a whole manner of people went in there and kicked his army out of Kuwait and quit. Fulfill the UN mandate. That's the only successful military operation in the post-World War II period. Period. There have been no others. And that's Washington. Now, others played parts. NATO played a part in the Balkans, for example, a very poor part. They played a part in Libya. They played a part in Afghanistan. But all of those were failures, abject failures. I don't know how anybody can classify it any other way. And when we get down the road about 50 years, historians will look back on it as one of the worst periods in the American Empire's history.
When it comes to the interaction between the countries within NATO, how did you find this interaction in Iraq, in Afghanistan? How did you find it in terms of their cooperation? How successful was that?
Well, in the first place, I'd have to go back and look at each episode, but I know this is accurate in a general sense. We never had NATO. You know, we put the patina of NATO on it, but we never had all of the countries of NATO, and most often we only had one or two. The British, maybe we had the Germans here, maybe we had the French here, but we never had a real alliance action. We like to pretend it was because we thought out of area operations, that's the term of art we use, was the new future of NATO. I always wondered how Article 5 applied to out of area operations, but no one seemed to be concerned about that. So the first thing is we never had all of NATO. Second, very poorly, even with the countries we had, take the NATO ISAF force help that was in Afghanistan. We don't do allies well in the United States. So what we do basically, same thing happened in Iraq with the coalition of the willing. What we do basically is we say, okay, you have this and we'll take this. And this for the United States is 80%. And this for whoever's from NATO is the 10% or 20%. Why don't you go over there and do your thing? We'll do our thing over here and don't bother us. We won't bother you. That's kind of the way the alliance works. And in Afghanistan, much of what we did with NATO was police type action or nation building type action, whether it was the Germans or the British or whatever. Even with the British, with the special relationship in Iraq, for example, Jeremy Greenstock, I think, would verify this for me. The British were kind of off doing their own thing down in Basra. We didn't want to deal with them. They didn't want to deal with us. That's sort of the way alliances work, especially if they're not existentially threatened and therefore fused by that threat. And NATO has not been that.